couple of minutes, 10-minute break in between the two lectures, and with discussion following the second lecture. So, St. Harry Reid.
I had suggested that. Are the acoustics strange in here? Can you hear me all right? People in the back, would you nod if you can hear me? I had suggested that we have discussion after the two presentations because the first is a rather general introductory presentation and by itself might possibly not elicit too much in the way of question or discussion. It tries to set the groundwork for the talks that will follow. What I'm going to be talking about in the course of a total of five discussions will be the split that took place in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940 and the split that took place in 1953. Three will be devoted to the 1940 split, and the next two to the 1953 split.
A little louder.
All right. It's a pretty well-known fact in political life that within the radical movement there have been numerous faction fights and splits. And it's equally well known that the Socialist Workers' Party has not been excluded from that process of factional struggles within its party and of splits resulting from those struggles. We have never apologized for that reality, but have instead considered it an inescapable, a necessary part of the process of building a mass revolutionary socialist party. All political groupings are subject to such factional struggles and to such splits. I think that it's fair to say, at least to my knowledge, that the Trotskyist movement, the Socialist Workers' Party, is probably the only one that takes the question of factional struggle, of splits, in a very serious way, makes a point of studying previous factional struggles, of trying to assemble all of the documents involved in them, and trying to draw lessons from them. Taken in that perspective, it can be said that the split that took place in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940 and in 1953 were the two most significant. They were the two big major factional struggles within our movement. There had been numerous others, but these two were the most basic, both in terms of the political issues involved and in terms of the political impact that these struggles had upon our own movement and on the radical movement generally. The split that took place in 1940 saw approximately half the membership of the Socialist Workers' Party and its youth section, then the Young People's Socialist League, leave our movement, and led by a number of very prominent founding members of our movement. So just from that viewpoint alone, it was obviously a very significant political development. The split in 1953, while taking away only about 20% of the membership of the organization, was just as serious in the sense that 20% were led by some of the people who were considered part of the central basic political leading cadre of our movement. Both of these factional fights were also the most fundamental in our history in terms of the issues that were in dispute. The factional groupings that developed in opposition to the party's program and leadership, seeking to change both its political program and leadership, posed not episodic or secondary questions, but the most fundamental issues relating to all of Marxist theory. Leon Trotsky, who was the founding figure of our movement, explained very early that basic ideological conflict within a political party is inevitably a reflection of various social and class pressures that exert themselves on a revolutionary movement. A movement can be completely revolutionary in its politics. Its members can be completely revolutionary in their thinking, but all of us live in this society, and none of us, no matter how conscious we may be, are totally immune from the various political and social pressures that exist within this capitalist society. We see that within the working class movement itself, how many workers are influenced by the ideas of other classes, ideas that are obviously inimical to their own interests as working people. How many working people accept middle class and even capitalist ideas, petty bourgeois and bourgeois ideas. We all know how many people are steeped in prejudice, in racism, sexism, prejudice against homosexuals, a whole variety of other things. And while conscious revolutionaries are far less subject to such social pressures, it would be utopian to think that they are completely immune to them. And when these pressures become intense enough, invariably, in one way or another, to one extent or another, they express themselves within a revolutionary Marxist party. In both the factional struggle that took place in our movement in 1940 and again in 1952-1953, the analysis was made by Trotsky in the case of the 1940 fight, by the leaders of the Socialist Workers' Party in 1952, Trotsky was already dead at that time, was that both of these struggles, the opposition groupings that developed within our party, represented the pressure and the penetration of petty bourgeois influences that were exercising a particular and very strong influence in society in general at the time and on the radical movement in particular. In 1940, the assessment was that this petty bourgeois pressure and influence and penetration into our movement ideologically was a direct one. In 1953, the assessment, the estimate was that again, petty bourgeois ideology was penetrating our movement, but this time as refracted through working class components within our movement. The first one in 1940 was a capitulation to a very powerful anti-Soviet sentiment that existed in this country at that time, and I'll discuss that in a bit. A capitulation to what's described in the politics of our movement as Stalinophobia, that is, a blind, unreasoned, emotional response against the regime in the Soviet Union in revulsion against the monstrous bureaucratic crimes committed by that regime, and most dramatically so during the period when Stalin was alive and held dictatorial power there. This mood was particularly intense among radical intellectuals of that period. The other middle class ideological influence that exerted itself in 1953 was, as I indicated, of a different kind. That reflected a period of extreme isolation of the radical movement, and most particularly the political isolation of its trade union activists, its trade union cadres. That fight took place at the peak of the long period of McCarthyism and Cold War and the Korean War in this country. There's a political logic to discussing both of these factional struggles in the same series of discussions. Each of them represent a particular phase in the political and historical development of the Trotskyist movement, and each of them reflected a particular political period, each one significantly different from the other. But I have felt for a long time that it is most fruitful to study these two factional struggles in tandem, because I think that each of them sheds light on the other and adds to the understanding. I think that studying both of these fights together provides a more rounded appreciation and understanding of each of them. Both were landmarks in the history of the Socialist Workers' Party. Considered together, they help to emphasize and to underline the fact that particular phases or chapters of party history can be grasped only in the context of the evolution and the development of the party. A study of history is, of course, essential for any serious political person, and a study of the history of a political movement like the Socialist Workers' Party is an absolutely indispensable requirement for an understanding of its present program and perspectives. But studying history means, in the Marxist sense, to study an unfolding process of political events, to learn from the past, but to recognize and to reject the shibboleth that history simply repeats itself. Each chapter sheds light and helps to illuminate a new chapter, a new development, and adds immeasurably to the understanding of it. But it's a political mistake, it's a mistake of political method to simply see one as a mechanical repetition of a previous one. The building of a revolutionary socialist party, a Marxist-Leninist party as we characterize it, is a process, not simply in terms of the ongoing activity of the movement. It is a process of elaborating a political program, of assembling a cadre of individuals with an understanding and a grasp of that program, an ability and a commitment and a willingness to go out and seek to apply that program and working toward the goal of building a mass working class revolutionary party that will one day be capable of leading the working people and the oppressed minorities of this country in a socialist revolution. That process of elaborating a political program, the ongoing elaboration of a program, can only be grasped as a living process. People will study the origins of our movement, the historic and classic documents, Trotsky's critique of the draft program of the which Congress was it? It wasn't the third, it was a later one, the sixth Congress, and that's a basic document or other basic documents, and we'll say, well, that's where the Trotskyist program was hammered out. And in one sense that's true, but in another sense that's a very limited and therefore inadequate and even incorrect comprehension of the political reality. The Socialist Labor Party, for example, elaborated a program and assembled a cadre some 90 years ago. Since that time, life has been very simple for them. They have the same program, and I suspect essentially the same cadre. The Trotskyist conception of a political program is that it is fundamental to the building of a movement. We begin with ideas and assemble a cadre around those ideas. It sounds like a very simple, logical, reasonable idea to people who accept our politics. But if you look at virtually every other political movement, you'll find that invariably they employ the opposite approach. That is, first you get together the cadres, and then you try to work out a program. And more often than not, it does not lead to very adequate results. And so that's one of the cornerstones, the basic conceptions of our movement, that it is in the process of elaborating a program that a cadre is assembled that is capable of carrying on the work that has to be done if a mass revolutionary socialist party is to be built. But elaborating the program is not done in the way that I am advised that the Lord created the universe, where he had a fixed period of time, I think it was 7 days, and the entire job was done. The history, the political history of a movement like the Socialist Workers' Party is one of a constant elaboration and development of the political program and of a constant evolution and elaboration of the strategy for assembling the cadres necessary to take that program and give it life. New events in the world, and there are always new events in the world, demand not only a rechecking of established political conceptions, a refinement of them, very often a modification, a rectification of them, but it also requires an elaboration of them. Each political epoch, as you study it, you will find throws up major new political problems which were not dealt with in the original program, so to speak, because the original program is not a metaphysical thing that looks ahead into the future in some mystical way. It deals with real political problems as they exist in the world and as our knowledge permits us to envision developments. But inevitably, each new stage of political development requires a further development and elaboration of the political program, and each new political stage of development, each new set of major political events, provide a new test of the capacity of the party, of its cadres, to continue to elaborate its program so that its program will be relevant to the events that are occurring. These tests take manifold forms. Some of them, most of them, are external. That is, the capacity of a revolutionary movement to relate to new struggles to develop, to new social forces that come into motion, to new forms of struggle that develop within the existing movement. This is always a test for revolutionaries. Other tests are of an internal character. That is, the capacity of the cadres of a revolutionary party to have a common approach, to work out a common ideological conception, and work in a unified way toward an agreed-upon program. And very often, the test of new developments, of new political events, provide both the internal and external tests combined. Now, 1940 The fight that erupted then was on the eve of the United States' entry into the Second World War. Jim Cannon, the founding leader of the American Trotskyist movement, made the observation at that time that our movement was extremely fortunate that this fight had erupted before the war began rather than in the midst of the war itself. And the developments that took place subsequently confirmed how correct his assessment was. The war itself provided significant tests for the Trotskyist movement. Immediately after the split occurred, which took away half the membership, there came the assassination of Leon Trotsky, which was a tremendous political blow to the Fourth International in general and to the Socialist Workers' Party in particular. Shortly after that, there erupted a very bitter struggle in the trade union movement in Minneapolis, where the Trotskyists had organized a massive Teamsters union, through that had won leadership in a major portion of the entire labor movement there, and where on the eve of the war, the trade union bureaucrats of the Teamsters Union, in combination with the Roosevelt administration and the Republican administration in the state of Minnesota, opened a struggle on two fronts to drive the Trotskyists out of the leadership of the Teamsters Union and to smash the union. They did it through goon squads that were sent into Minneapolis to literally drive the Teamsters activists out of their trucks and off the streets, and they did it through the Roosevelt administration with the first indictment under the Smith Act that was carried through, and where, because of the opposition of the Socialist Workers' Party to the war and because of the resolute stand taken by the Trotskyist leaders of the Teamsters Union in Minneapolis, a whole section of the decisive leadership of the SWP went to prison in the course of the war. So it was a very difficult period, and if there had been a major factional struggle within the party during such a period, it could very well have raised the question of whether or not the party would have had the resources to survive that kind of a test. The party did survive both the faction fight in 1940. It did survive the whole difficult war period, and it was a difficult one. I don't know of any other radical party that refused to give political support to the United States government in that so-called war for democracy and against fascism. The Socialist Workers' Party took the position that the war was as much an imperialist war on the part of the United States government as it was on the part of the Axis powers, and that the struggle against fascism could not be left to an imperialist government. This was not at all a popular position. The great majority of the American people, either actively or passively, saw it as necessary to support the war. They did see it genuinely as a war against fascism, so it was not a popular position, with the central leadership of the party in prison, with other victimizations that were leveled against our movement apart from Minneapolis. It was difficult, and yet we emerged from that period stronger. The movement was larger and stronger when the war ended than when the war began. Why is a whole interesting subject in itself. There was the big labor upsurge that followed the end of the war, that actually began during the war, that reached its height with the big strike wave, 1946. And then, in a short time after that, 1948, the opening of the Cold War, nearly two decades uninterrupted of prosperity in the country, Cold War, witch hunt, McCarthyism, the Korean War, all of these events, again, providing a test of the capacity of the Trotskyist movement. And internally, a test was provided again, this time by the factional struggle that erupted in 1952 and 1953. Again, we survived that. The turning point for our movement, for radicalism generally, came in 1956 with the Montgomery bus boycott movement, the first major organized mass civil rights struggle in the South, with the profound repercussions that it had throughout the country. Internationally, at the same period, with the 20th Congress of the Soviet Congress Communist Party, the sensational speech by Khrushchev confirming and denouncing the monstrous crimes of Stalinism, of Stalin, the enormous political impact that this had on the communist parties throughout the world, the crisis that it created in these parties, and the profound effect that it had on the radical movement as a whole throughout the world. It's interesting to think a moment, incidentally, if I seem to be getting way ahead of my subject, what I am trying to do is, as I indicated earlier, to put these two factional struggles within a certain historical context, which I hope will help shed additional light on them. The 1956 period, the first opportunity for our movement to begin to break out of the isolation that had begun in 1948 and just beginning opportunities, came with both these events, the Montgomery bus boycott and the Khrushchev revelations, which in essence confirmed what the Trotskyist movement had been saying for several decades previously about the meaning and the character and the crimes of Stalinism. And with our small forces, we had the problem of trying to relate to both of these developments. And it was no simple matter to do that. At that time, we had a militant that was a four-page standard size that would be the equivalent of an eight-page tabloid, as contrasted to the 24 pages that we have today. As soon as the Montgomery bus boycott developed, we sought to establish contact with it. Our movement was totally isolated from the South at that period. We literally didn't know the name of a single person in Montgomery. I doubt that we had a half a dozen subscribers to the militant throughout the entire South. We sent Fred Halstead, our staff writer for the militant, then down there by Greyhound bus, and that was a big deal for us at that time, to put somebody on the bus and send them all the way down to Montgomery, Alabama. And we were able to intervene. Farrell Dobbs went down there, others. We helped to publicize nationally what they were doing in the pages of the militant, helped to rally some material support for them in the North. And we began to establish a relationship with them. I remember what an event it was for us when the Montgomery Improvement Association, the organizer of the boycott, ordered a bundle of militants so that they could begin to distribute it to their members in Montgomery, a major breakthrough for a small, isolated movement that had been through 8 years of isolation, witch hunt, so on. And the first bundle that we sent down to them, the edition of the paper came out immediately after major revelations in Poland confirming the fact of anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, something that had a profound impact on the communist parties throughout the world, and particularly the Communist Party in the United States. And we had to make a political decision as to which was going to be the lead headline in the militant. And the lead headline was an extremely obscure thing, except for those who follow international political events. It was something about the name of a Polish Jewish newspaper reveals facts of anti-Semitism and the persecution of Jews in Soviet Union. And that was the first issue that we sent a bundle of down to Montgomery, Alabama, in the middle of their bus boycott. I present this contradiction to you, and it was a very real contradiction. It pointed up what we already knew, that you need a bigger paper so that you don't have to focus on just one thing at a time. But we had to make a decision. And the decision, while it was in a sense a painful one, to feature the item relating to the Soviet Union rather than what was going on in Montgomery, flowed from our conception that our basic job then, as in a different sense, in a much better way now, remained the assembling of a political cadre and the winning of political hegemony within the radical movement. That if we did not succeed in carrying out that basic task of assembling a cadre and of elaborating a program that's capable of competing with the other radical tendencies, particularly with the then very powerful Communist Party, that all of the mass work activity in the world that we might do with the Montgomery Improvement Association or anyone else would simply go down the drain. And we had to make that very hard political choice that we had to focus first on this whole question of the exposure of the crimes of Stalinism, to utilize it to deliver body blows at the Communist Party, to gain strength in relationship to them at the expense of the work in Montgomery. We managed to continue to do some good work there, and we did make gains. But it was a contradiction, and we had to make a choice. And as I go along, I hope the reason will appear a bit less obscure than it does on first statement. There followed immediately after that a whole process in relationship to the Communist Party. A major crisis developed in the large circles around the Communist Party. We intervened in that process very vigorously. There developed what was known in the radical movement of that period in the late 50s, a process of socialist regroupment, where groups that had previously been isolated from each other would not work with each other, would not even speak with each other, frequently where there were attacks, physical attacks on our movement, other movements by CP groups and so on. Discussion began, an exchange of ideas began among many of these forces, common activity began to develop, and a whole new relationship of forces began to develop within the radical movement that again helped us to gain additional cadres and to strengthen our position in relationship to competitive forces. It was also during that period that we gained our first young people, our first youth cadres for a youth movement. One of the interesting and striking features of our movement, I think, and one of the testimonials of its capacity to survive through difficult political times, is the fact that for a period of 20 years, the American Trotskyist movement did not have a national youth organization. From the period of 1940, when this split took place that I told you about, until I think it was 1960 or maybe 59, that the 58, the formal founding of the YSA, all right, that's a period of 18 years, there was no national youth organization. And the first cadres for a national youth organization were assembled out of this whole regroupment process. Some young people that we won from the Communist Party circles, some young left-wing social democrats from a group that had been part of the group that left our party in 1940, and some young people that we recruited independently during this period provided the foundations for the establishment of the Young Socialist Alliance. From then on, things continued to move in a healthier direction. 1960, the Cuban Revolution, the upsurge of the black struggle in the South, the students, the black students' organization of the lunch counter sit-ins, the response of the students of that in the North, the whole development of black nationalism in the early 60s is focused around Malcolm X. All of these things helped us to assemble further cadres. 1965 came the Vietnam War. The process of intervention and the organization of the anti-war movement by the Trotskyist movement, the singular contribution that our movement made to that development and continues to make today, the relationship that our movement has had, the viable, energetic intervention in the women's liberation movement, the gay liberation movement, the Chicano movement, all of the new movements of struggle that have developed in this country. In the same time, over this whole period, our party made significant theoretical contributions, which were part of this process of the continuing elaboration of a political program. And there were knotty political problems and theoretical problems throughout this whole period. There was a whole process of the disintegration and the overthrow and the abolition of capitalism in Eastern Europe, a process which seemed to refute the general conceptions of our movement that the process of the overthrow of capitalism could be achieved only under the leadership of a Marxist-Leninist party. It took a whole variety of bastardized forms within Eastern Europe. It was a completely new phenomenon in the world. As Marxists, we had to examine that process over a period of a number of years and to elaborate a theoretical explanation of precisely what had occurred and why and what it meant in terms of our political program. The Chinese Revolution, again, presented new political and theoretical problems, new events that had not been anticipated, a development in a form that had not been anticipated. Again, it was the obligation of Marxists to study, to analyze, to discuss, to think out, to debate out, and to arrive at a thought-out analysis of that. The Cuban Revolution, again, a completely new and different kind of a phenomena. I think we can say that it was the Trotskyists that provided a serious theoretical analysis of what actually occurred in Cuba, what lessons were to be drawn from it. The development of nationalism in this country, in a period when virtually the entire radical movement was denouncing Malcolm X and the movement that he represented as reactionary, as racist in reverse, and so on, our movement was elaborating an analysis of black nationalism and why it was a profoundly progressive and revolutionary development. And we see today the Socialist Workers' Party and the Young Socialist Alliance grappling with and assessing and probing and developing an analysis of the deep-going radicalization that embraces this country today and, in fact, most parts of the world. I have given you this very rapid and very, going to say simple, oversimplified is probably better, picture of this development. My thought was not in any way to suggest that we've got a perfect record, that we saw everything, that we understood everything, that we were right on the button with everything. That has no relationship to the reality. We made these major contributions. They account for the fact that our movement survived extreme difficulties and has actually gained significant ground, but in the course of the process, we made mistakes as well. Leon Trotsky's analysis of the Second World War, made before the outbreak of the world, is probably as comprehensive and as meaningful as any as you will find. But again, it was a projection and anticipation of events to come, and there were limitations to it. Trotsky's estimate, his prognosis, for example, that the war inevitably would end with socialist revolution, and that along with that, with a political revolution in the Soviet Union, was not borne out in the sense that he elaborated it. There was another whole period at the end of the war where we sought to assess the development of the European economy, the prospects for the economic and political developments of that period. If you go back and study that, you will find that in the immediate analyses that we made, that many of our prognoses were incorrect. If you study the material that we wrote during the McCarthy period, you can go through it very carefully. It's my own opinion. You'll find there a number of errors of estimate as to the extent and the depth of the McCarthyite phenomena. When you study the fight, as we will discuss here, and as I hope you will study more adequately, with the Cochrane faction in our party in 1953, as you read the documents, I think you will agree that on a number of specific issues that our estimate were not correct and our conclusions were not correct. But on the whole, I say, we passed the key test. We met the major political developments, both externally and internally, both from a theoretical viewpoint and from the viewpoint of elaborating political strategy, that is, of determining where and how to put our limited cadres to the best use and assembling further cadres. So our movement then is one that has been in a constant process of political struggle, external and internal, a process of constant political evolution. These two fights were not only among the most important chapters in our history, but they provided some of the most enduring contributions to political theory produced by our movement. Leon Trotsky's book, In Defense of Marxism, which is a compilation of his writings in the course of that factional struggle, was his last major work, and in many senses, one of his richest works. In his Diary in Exile, written in France, he made the observation that out of his whole rich political history, that he considered the most important phase of his political life the period that he devoted his energies to the organization and the building of the Fourth International. He said this was the most important single political contribution of his entire political career. And he meant that very seriously. And when the fight erupted in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940, he assessed that fight as a crucial stage in the process of the development of the Fourth International. He saw it both in terms of the role that the United States plays in the world, and therefore the special importance of building a revolutionary socialist party in the United States, and he saw it in terms of the basic political issues that were in dispute in that fight, and it was because of that that he entered into very direct collaboration with the leaders of the Socialist Workers' Party in the political struggle against the opposition that developed, played a major role not only with his theoretical contributions, but in day-to-day collaboration in the development of the political strategy in the carrying through of that fight. All of this is by way of introduction to the fight that took place in 1940. So if it's agreeable with you, I propose that we take a break at this time, and then we can get down to what we came here to talk about.
This will be a 10-minute break, so we'll want to get back in exactly 10 minutes.
Just as Leon Trotsky's work in defense of Marxism was one of the major products and benefit of the factional struggle that developed in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940 of equal importance and value is the book by James P. Cannon, which is complementary to Trotsky's, and that is the book The Struggle for a Proletarian Party, which is a compilation of articles, letters, speeches by Cannon in the course of that fight. That, along with other of his writings on the problem of political organization, in my belief, are absolutely indispensable for a meaningful grasp of what is involved in actually organizing and building a revolutionary socialist movement. To my knowledge, it's the most concrete work yet available on the whole question of the political and organizational character of a revolutionary Marxist party, and of the process, you might even say the art, of party building. The Struggle for a Proletarian Party makes comprehensible the absolutely indivisible link between organizational conceptions and the political program that those organizational conceptions serve and are designed to carry out. In studying this book, you'll find that it deals with such key questions as what is the character, what is the role of a revolutionary leadership within a Leninist party? What are the responsibilities, the obligations, duties, and the privileges of membership in a Leninist party? How do you make a political assessment of a given leadership of a political party? What is the interrelationship between the democratic aspect and the centralist aspect of the conception of democratic centralism? What is meant by a political bloc within and among radical parties? What is considered to be a principled bloc, an unprincipled one? What would you regard as informal, positive, beneficial, necessary collaboration among leaders? And in contrast, how would you assess a clique and what the role and meaning and the function of a clique is within a political party? These are but some of the questions that are dealt with in a more concrete way than any other Marxist or Leninist writing that I'm aware of. I think that this book, along with Cannon's History of American Trotskyism, his book on the first 10 years of American Communism, his letters from prison, and equally, if not more important, his forthcoming book, Documents in the Fight in 1953 with Cochran, a book that promises to be available by the time of the SWP convention this August, that these taken together, these writings, constitute a major contribution to Marxist theory, and I would make the flat, even dogmatic statement that you cannot say that you really comprehend what Leninist political organization is about unless you make a very serious study of these works. Now, the 1940 fight. The opposition that developed within the Socialist Party was led by extremely prominent leaders of the party. The Trotskyist movement in this country, as you probably know, or many of you know, was founded by three leading figures in the Communist Party: James P. Cannon, Max Shakman, and Martin Ahern. Max Shakman, Martin Ahern, along with James Burnham, then a very prominent, gifted intellectual, radical intellectual of the 30s. These were the four principal leaders of the opposition that developed within the Socialist Workers' Party. It was an extremely hard-fought political clash, which touched on almost all of the basic political and philosophical issues on which Marxist theory is based. There was a major debate between Trotsky and Burnham on the whole question of philosophical and political method, whether or not the Marxist conception of dialectical materialism is in fact a scientific, valid, and politically meaningful one, or, as Burnham argued, essentially a metaphysical concept that offered no real tool in political analysis. A question on which the Trotskyist movement had been built in large measure. The whole analysis of the character of the Soviet Union, which under Stalin was characterized and analyzed by the Trotskyist movement as a degenerated worker state, but one that should be defended without condition against imperialism. This too was challenged by the bloc led by Shakman, Burnham, and Ahern. And in addition, they challenged the whole organizational conceptions, the Marxist-Leninist conceptions of how a political party should be organized. So it's apparent that this was a serious political struggle. From the viewpoint of the figures that were involved in the leadership of the struggle and the issues that were actually in dispute, I propose to deal somewhat with each of the questions except the first, that is the question of the Marxist method of dialectical materialism. It's a complex question, one that cannot easily be presented in a cogent way in a brief period of time, and even if it were possible to do that, I don't consider myself qualified to make a serious contribution in the field, so I don't propose to attempt to do so. I would simply urge that you study the writings of Trotsky on this question as contained in the book In Defense of Marxism. The very fine introduction to that book by Joseph Hansen and George Novak, writing under the pen name William Ward, I found three pages there, a very excellent synopsis of the general conception of the dialectic. They're pages 16 through 18 of the introduction. There are, of course, the classic works that are available on the questions, the writings of Marx, Engels, Plekhanov, Labriola, and others. There is the works of George Novak. If you have available old internal bulletins of the Socialist Workers' Party, you'll find some interesting material and debate in there. In the middle 40s, there was a debate with a man by the name of Mark Loris, who put forward the hypothesis that dialectical materialism was a valid method for politics, but not a valid method in relationship to other science, and a very interesting debate developed around that point that was published in the internal bulletin of the Socialist Workers' Party of that period. And those of you who are interested in going more deeply into the question, it's worth digging out those bulletins if you can. There was a later, lesser discussion within the party, if I recall correctly, in the period around 1947-48, where two comrades, Irving Hyper and Buddy Lenz, presented a view which I frankly did not quite comprehend. The Marxist conception that ideas are a reflection of reality, they said that's not a Marxist conception, that's an idealistic conception, that ideas are not a reflection of reality, ideas are a reality. And they apparently had a good deal of knowledge of the physical sciences, and they offered a good deal of evidence about measuring wavelengths of ideas and so on, which I still felt that ideas are a reflection of reality, but I had to skip the question of whether or not they are also a physical reality. Now, the next major question in dispute in this fight was on the question of the Soviet Union. Our analysis of the class character of the Soviet Union and what our attitude should be toward the defense of the Soviet Union as opposed to the imperialist capitalist power. This has always been a basic question for our movement and has been for the entire radical movement ever since the Russian Revolution of 1917. The Socialist Party split essentially on the question of attitude toward the early Soviet Republic, and the Communist Party was born out of that split and out of its adherence to the Soviet Union and the revolution that it embodied. The Trotskyist movement developed the left opposition around this question, and in large measure it was the basis for the expulsion of the left opposition led by Cannon, Shachtman, and Ahern in 1928. The most concrete analysis of the class character of the Soviet Union will be found, in addition to the writings and in defense of Marxism, in Trotsky's book, The Revolution Betrayed, which offers the most fully elaborated depiction and scientific analysis of the bureaucracy that came to power in the Soviet Union, what that bureaucracy represented, how it came to power, what the meaning and the character of its power was. Let me give you simply a shorthand view of the Trotskyist analysis of the Soviet Union. It was born of the Revolution of 1917, which abolished capitalism in Russia, organized in its place a nationalized economy based upon production for use rather than for profit, organized a monopoly of foreign trade so that the nationalized economy could relate as such to the world market, instituted economic planning, and established through the Soviets or councils working class democracy within the Soviet Union. That was characterized by the Marxists of the period as a workers' state, or more precisely by Lenin, as a workers' state with bureaucratic deformation, explaining that a workers' state existing in an isolated backward country could not possibly be free of bureaucratic deformations, and he added that necessary qualification to the concept of a workers' state. Those bureaucratic deformations, which Lenin so correctly noted, increased over a period of time to the point where the quantity became quality and the process of deformation became one by the late 20s and early 30s of a process of degeneration. There are a whole series of factors which are explained by Trotsky in his writings, which are explained to a good degree, although not as well, by Deutscher in his trilogy on Trotsky, which were responsible for this process of degeneration that took place within the worker state established by the 1917 revolution. The exhaustion of the masses of the Soviet Union, of the workers, the peasants, the revolutionary soldiers, as a result of the long, costly civil war fought within the country and against the imperialist intervention. The terrible chaos of taking over an utterly underdeveloped economy, the famine that resulted from the chaos in the economy, the war, the imperialist intervention, the lack of an adequate managerial staff, all of the other problems. The encirclement of the Soviet Union by hostile capitalist forces, the inability in that period of the revolution in the Soviet Union to extend into other countries that could give aid to the Soviet Union. The aborted German Revolution of 1919 and of 1921 and 23, the defeat of the British general strike in 1926, the slaughter by Chiang Kai-shek of the revolutionary forces in 1927. All of these factors combined, the scarcity, extreme difficulties, the war weariness of the revolutionary cadres and of the masses, with the development of an economically privileged bureaucracy in the Soviet Union, numbering literally in the millions, government and party functionaries, factory managers, farm managers, army officers, police officers, people who in a period of extreme scarcity utilized their position of power and privilege to gain for themselves material things that were denied the masses of people. A bureaucracy with many different parts to it, many of them in conflict with each other in terms of their economic and social interest, with Stalin arising as the arbiter between the various sectors of this privileged bureaucracy, which had come into complete power by smashing the Soviets, by establishing a terrible dictatorial rule, mass frame-ups, mass purges, imprisonments, executions, literally in the millions, wiping out of an entire generation of revolutionaries, including virtually the entire initial leadership of the Russian Revolution. And at the same time, the pursuit of a reactionary foreign policy designed to help ensure the stability of this privilege-seeking bureaucracy at home, a reformist policy of giving up and consciously opposing any movement for socialism in other countries, of actually opposing revolutionary developments for the sake of an agreement to deal with one or another sector of imperialism that would leave the Soviet bureaucracy in peace, in much the same manner that union bureaucrats will seek to make deals with the bosses at the expense of the workers for the sake of assuring their particular privileged position as opposed to the needs and the interests of the workers that they are supposed to represent. In 1933, this treacherous policy of the Stalinist bureaucracy led to the paralysis of the powerful German Communist Party, an utterly false, bankrupt policy that made it possible for Hitler to come to power in the face of a communist and socialist party in that country that commanded the allegiance, literally, of the majority of the working class and of the population generally. And it was in that period of 1933, after the terrible defeat of the German working class, that the Trotskyist movement made the analysis that the degeneration of the Soviet Union and of the communist parties throughout the world, which had come under the domination of Stalinism, had reached the point where they were beyond reform, that it was no longer possible to eliminate this bureaucracy within the Soviet Union except through a political revolution, that it was no longer possible to get the communist parties of the world back onto a revolutionary path, that it was necessary to build a new revolutionary international, a fourth international. So these were the key points in the analysis of the Trotskyist movement, beginning with this period of 1933, the Soviet Union as a degenerated worker state, a bureaucracy that could be removed only by revolutionary means, with such a revolutionary process characterized as a political revolution as contrasted to a social revolution. In a capitalist country where you have to achieve, to make a revolution, a fundamental reorganization of the economy, the dislodging of the capitalist class from economic power, the taking over of economic power by the working class, and at the same time the dislodging of the capitalist class from political power, the destruction of its political forms of rule, the creation of a workers' form of rule, a workers' state, this is a social revolution. In the Soviet Union, a workers' state, by contrast, where the economy was nationalized, where capitalist forms had been eliminated, there was no need for a social revolution. What was needed was a political revolution which would destroy the bureaucratic regime and reestablish the democratic Soviet forms that had been originally initiated by the revolution. At the same time, the Trotskyist movement took the position that despite the degeneration in the Soviet Union, that the workers' state remained, as contrasted to capitalism, a more progressive social form, and that it had to be defended against the attempts of the capitalist class to destroy it, which was from the very outset and which remains the perspective of world capitalism. And we took the position which was presented in the formula, the unconditional defense of the Soviet Union against imperialism. And it's important to understand the full meaning of that phrase, unconditional defense. By that we meant in that any struggle that occurs between the Soviet Union, and this was later extended to the other worker states that were created, in any struggle between the worker state, no matter how degenerated, and imperialism, we stand for the defense of the worker state, and we do so despite our opposition to the regime, and despite our political program for a political revolution for the overthrow of that regime. What this means in political practice is that in a period of clash between the worker state and imperialism, the struggle for the political revolution within the worker state is subordinated to the defense of the Soviet Union against imperialism. Subordinated but not abandoned. We took the position that it is necessary to continue to maintain the opposition to the bureaucracy, to give it no political support of any kind, but to join in the Soviet Union and internationally in the defense independently of the Soviet Union against imperialism. The example or analogy is often given of our attitude toward a union which is run by gangsters and bureaucrats who have to be thrown out of office if the workers are going to utilize the union to effectively serve their needs. While we continue to maintain our opposition to the union bureaucrats, the thugs and gangsters, such a union went on strike against the bosses, we stand unconditionally for the victory of the union, and we subordinate our struggle against the bureaucrats to the struggle against the bosses. Subordinating it means precisely that you would not take an action against the bureaucracy which could, in practical terms, offer an advantage to the imperialist. if the struggle can be carried out in such a way that it does not offer that opportunity to the imperialist, then you would continue the struggle, and if it were possible, taking the thing in its general theoretical form, to actually carry out the political revolution while a war against imperialism was going on without assuring the victory of imperialism, it would be perfectly correct and proper politically to do so. And in fact, there could be conditions where carrying through such a political revolution might be absolutely essential and indispensable for achieving victory against the imperialists. So unconditional defense meant not that we in any way qualified or watered down our opposition to the regime, but that we subordinated our struggle against the regime to the struggle against imperialism. And unconditional simply meant that in defending the degenerated worker state, we place no prior conditions on the bureaucracy for that defense, that we would defend it despite them and against them. That analysis of the class character of the Soviet Union as a degenerated worker state and the programmatic conclusion that we drew from it, that is, the need for a political revolution, but the subordination of that political revolution to the defense of the Soviet Union against imperialism, has been a key factor in world politics. Trotsky's analysis, and it was he who principally elaborated this whole analysis of the degenerated worker state, of the bureaucratic caste that came to power there, the process of degeneration that occurred, how and why, is indispensable not only for an understanding of what is happening in the Soviet Union, but for an understanding of the world role of Stalinism. One of the principal and most costly aspects of that degeneration was the criminal, reactionary, reformist, and counter-revolutionary role played by the Stalinist parties under the domination of the Kremlin in the world. Today it is embodied in the whole theory of peaceful coexistence, that is, international class collaboration with the capitalist at the expense of masses struggling for their liberation. An understanding of this is absolutely crucial and vital for revolutionaries, the fullest and deepest understanding. Revolutionaries who fail to understand that can make some terribly costly errors. The Cubans, I think, are among those, Fidel, Che, even, to learn fully the meaning of counter-revolutionary Stalinism. My own reading of Che's diary persuaded me that the most costly mistake that Che made was, even as anti-Stalinist as he was, and he really was an anti-Stalinist, that Che did not fully grasp that the communist parties under the domination of the Kremlin are not simply conservative, are not simply non-revolutionary, but that they are consciously and actively counter-revolutionary. And Che went into Bolivia with the perspective that he could maneuver with this party, that he could somehow drive a wedge within its leadership and could win part of it over to active support of the revolution. And it's my own personal view that this was one of the things that led to his betrayal and to his defeat and to his death. No, it's not only in the colonial world that it's necessary to understand the consciously counter-revolutionary role of Stalinism. It's necessary if you're going to understand the role of the communist parties in the advanced capitalist countries. It's the only way you can explain the whole perfidious role of the Communist Party of France during the titanic struggles of May and June of 68, when the workers and the students virtually had power in their hands. And the only thing that prevented that from developing into a genuine revolutionary struggle for power was the reactionary influence and the counter-revolutionary influence of the Communist Party of France. And we see it within the Soviet bloc. The whole refutation of the theory first advanced by Isaac Deutscher, which he later had to retreat from in the face of events, the crushing of the Hungarian Revolution, the attempt to crush the movement for independence in Poland, the invasion of Czechoslovakia, all of the terrible crimes that have been committed against the people of Eastern Europe and their efforts to achieve some semblance of socialist democracy. To understand all of these things, the question of the class character of the Soviet Union, the character of the bureaucracy that rules it, its political physiognomy, is absolutely essential. And it is, of course, decisive in a war, in a world that is divided between an imperialist and the non-capitalist countries today. The only force in the world today that can take a clear and unambiguous position against the efforts of the imperialists to smash the colonial liberation movements, to smash those regimes where capitalism has been abolished, and at the same time continue to maintain an independent revolutionary struggle without compromise with any of these reactionary forces are the Trotskyists, actually. And that is based in large measure on their Marxist analysis of the nature and the role of the Kremlin bureaucracy and now of the Maoist bureaucracy as well. In this present world, to maintain an independent revolutionary line that does not conciliate either with imperialism or with Stalinism, such a position, such an analysis, is absolutely indispensable. It was the downfall, the political downfall of Burnham and Shachtman, the two principal leaders of this opposition in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940, that they did not understand this question. Burnham didn't get pushed by social pressure away from the position, the traditional position of the Trotskyist movement. He jumped. Shachtman was dragged along in his wake and on his coattails, and the same with Abern. In 1937 already, Burnham, who had joined our movement as a result of a fusion that had taken place earlier in 1935 with the American Workers' Party, led by A.J. Mustey. As early as 1937, Burnham raised the question of whether or not it was still correct to characterize the Soviet Union as a worker state. He did not offer a definitive answer to the question. He merely posed it in the course of a pre-convention discussion prior to the founding convention of the Socialist Workers' Party in 1938. By 1939, Burnham had developed a fully thought-out theory in relationship to the Soviet Union. He said that the Trotskyist analysis, the conception of a degenerated worker state, was incorrect. It was false. That there was no longer a worker state in Russia, that what you had there was the ascent to power of a new class, what he called a bureaucratic collective class. And later, after he left the movement completely and began its very rapid evolution to the right, as you know, he's now a McCarthyite, the old McCarthy, one of the editors of the reactionary magazine Monthly Review. Now that would be a poor joke. He developed this theory of a new bureaucratic collective class, and a theory that was in a book that was fairly popular when he wrote it, I think in the early 40s, called The Managerial Revolution, in which he explained that out of both the capitalist societies and the workers' states was evolving a whole new class of technicians, of managers, and that these were going to be the rulers of the world. He first presented that in a resolution to the party, then curiously withdrew that resolution, did not ask the party to act upon it. His